Hi, I'm David Boyer, and I want to let you know we're in our March membership campaign. We are listener-supported radio, and twice a year, we ask for your help. I invite you to contribute right now to support local independent journalism. Go to kalw.org and click donate. Thanks.
KALW.
The new directive coming out of the Bay Area and the six counties is no gatherings, which just makes sense to me.
It's day one of the Bay Area shelter-in-place order.
A lot of these restaurants, they bought a lot of food that could last for 2-3 weeks. But now with this closure, a lot of this food has to be thrown away.
The latest on the effects of COVID-19. Then, when there's a health crisis, what happens to our already existing housing crisis?
If there's one thing this crisis has really exposed, it's that our inability to house all of our citizens is even more of an outrage now.
And a story from Lake Merritt as it celebrates 150 years as a wildlife refuge for the birds.
My job was usually, because I was small and quick, I could grab some of these ducks.
I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. The Bay Area woke up today sheltering in place after an order in effect since midnight. Millions are staying at home. Only essential services are available. Here with the latest is KALW's Deputy News Director, Angela Johnston.
Last night, Governor Gavin Newsom gave a speech on Facebook Live.
Good to be with you, at least all virtually, this evening.
It's where a lot of people are communicating these days. He told Californians he would be extending our restrictions here in the Bay Area to the entire state.
We are directing those gyms and the health clubs to close down for the moment, as well as those movie theaters, and then strengthening our focus on restaurants to align with Bay Area, align with those larger counties, and asking our restaurants to close down for the moment, provide takeout if they wish.
It's unclear if the governor's new guidelines will be enforced. In his speech, he also said he's working with the California Public Utilities Commission to make sure that people who can't pay their utility bills won't be cut off. He also spoke to the testing shortage.
Another area of concern, consistent concern, is in the testing space. We have increased by a few hundred the number of tests that we provided just in the last 24 hours in our public labs. Those are the 19 labs that currently are testing, but that clearly is not enough. And so,
as of today, the California Department of Public Health is reporting 472 confirmed coronavirus cases in the state. Here in the Bay Area, some facilities are ramping up testing, but most sites require a doctor's note. We'll post a link on our website with that information. Today, Napa and Sonoma counties join most other Bay Area counties with shelter-in-place orders. That means all non-essential businesses should be closed. In Fremont, Tesla's decided not to shut down, despite the orders. Auto manufacturers aren't considered an essential service, but the San Francisco Chronicle is reporting that a plant manager told employees they should still come to work. Over 10,000 employees travel to and from the plant. There's some debate about whether marijuana dispensaries are considered an essential service. And yesterday, I heard there were very long lines at many of them. But today, in San Francisco, they're closed. In San Jose, however, the city just ruled that dispensaries could stay open, as long as they enforce social distancing rules. That means 6 feet between each person. The shutdown order includes places like gyms, retail shops, except hardware stores, and bars. Bars and restaurants and their workers are already feeling severe economic impacts. Calvin Louie is an accountant who works with a lot of businesses in San Francisco's Chinatown.
I think it's impacted Chinatown tremendously. People don't realize a lot of these restaurants, they bought a lot of food that could last for 2-3 weeks. But now with this closure, a lot of this food has to be thrown away.
I've seen numerous restaurant owners post big signs in their windows saying that they're still open for takeout and delivery. And I've heard other community members encourage each other to buy gift cards and online merchandise for shops, bars, and restaurants that have to close. The San Francisco Chronicle's food critic, Soleil Ho, is starting a thread on Instagram where restaurant workers and owners can share info about who is open and who is giving out food to those in need. Che Fico on Divisadero says they're giving out free dinners for families in need every night. Azalina's, a Malaysian restaurant on Market Street, is also providing free meals to those in need and free freezer space for other restaurant folks. They say they're in full swing cooking up meals from all the inventory they can't use and donating it to whoever needs it. In San Francisco, I'm Angela Johnston for Cross Currents.
Thanks, Angela. Angela Johnston is KELW's deputy news director. And our news team is providing updates at our website, kalw.org. Tell us what you want to know. Call our newsroom at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Or send your questions to news@kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. America's in a health crisis, but it's also been in a housing crisis. Many of us have been thinking about our rents and unhoused people in these times. For almost a quarter of renters, more than half their income goes to their landlord. Eviction displaces a million households a year. About 4 million people spend at least 3 hours driving to and from work. These issues are the backdrop of Connor Doherty's new book, Golden Gates, Fighting for Housing in America. In the book, he tackles the Bay Area housing crisis through a cast of characters, the politicians, the developers, the tech workers. Doherty is also a New York Times economy reporter, and I called him up. We talked about what happens to the housing crisis in a time of a health pandemic.
So much has changed in the past week. I've never seen anything change so rapidly and so violently. Mm. I will be talking to a business on like a Monday and they're like, everything seems fine. By Wednesday, they're talking about laying people off. Big businesses are calling about calling board meetings. Small businesses are talking about, will they even survive? That's happening in literally hours. So priorities around the country have changed. Things we thought were problems aren't problems. But the one thing I really feel confident saying is that housing is right where it was, still a huge priority as much as it ever was before this. Because if there's one thing this crisis has really exposed, it's that our inability to house all of our citizens, which was a moral outrage long before this, is even more of an outrage now. And on top of that, people who are so close to getting kicked out of their homes when the economy is, by all accounts, performing well, as it was before the coronavirus outbreak, I think we need to really reevaluate how we're doing housing in this country. We're not even prepared for a crisis. For even a minor dislocation, people can lose their homes over one lost paycheck, one lost month, one $300-$500 rent increase. Mm-hmm. If that's the state of affairs in normal times, in good times, where are we in even moderately bad times, let alone, you know, the worst times ever, which is what we're in now.
Right.
And I think housing remains at the highest priority. Now, we will get through this, assuming we don't turn into the Walking Dead and we're all walking around with, you know, in bandanas with bullets and whatnot.
Maybe.
We will get through this. And if we do, I believe that cities and density and all these things that we were talking about before this outbreak will remain relevant.
Your book is subtitled Fighting for Housing in America, Golden Gates, Fighting for Housing in America. So you don't think going through this crisis is going to change anything about that fight?
The book is titled Golden Gates because it's kind of like a metaphor. The idea is that we have erected a set of gates, golden gates, in the form of high rents and high home prices, and that those gates are preventing people from moving to cities where the largest amount of economic mobility happens. Mm-hmm. If you want to see the worst form of poverty, it is not in cities. It is in rural places where you have no idea how they're ever going to get out of it. You have no concept of how they could get a job in a factory or a company or become a teacher or get educated. You just look at rural poverty and you just think, there's nothing here. There's nothing to do. I don't understand how anyone is going to get out of this. But you go to a city and you look around and you go, well, there's schools, there's charities, there's all sorts of government programs. And the best economic program we have for helping people get ahead in the world is making it easier for them to live in places where, like, a lot's going on. So one of the things we know about cities is that they have the highest economic inequality, and we see that every day, mm-hmm. but they also have the highest economic mobility.
Mm-hmm. After we emerge from this, what are you going to be, like, monitoring, thinking about, looking at?
We are going to need a massive stimulus, and that is going to be something that the power of the federal government can only deliver. Mm-hmm. That's step one. We're going to need all these eviction moratoriums and all these other things that local governments are doing. But at the highest possible level, we are going to need vast amounts of money injected into this economy. So that's what we're going to need. We're going to need to remind ourselves also that these systems that we've let atrophy, public health and all these other things, that this is why they're there. I mean, we all give so much, you know, through churches, through community groups, through our schools. Even very poor people give so much when they're kind of called to do something for their community. And yet, when we ask ourselves to do this through politics, through taxes, it becomes this, you know, highly intellectual argument. And I just hope that maybe we've absorbed how much we do need actual strong systems that also protect us when it's needed.
Connor Doherty is economy reporter for the New York Times and author of the book Golden Gates, Fighting for Housing in America. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Oakland is blessed with a lake in the middle of the city. There's 3 miles of path around it for people to walk, jog, and ride bikes. On the weekends, people picnic and barbecue on the lawns. They play drums under the pergola and row boats in its water. At night, strands of white lights strung between lampposts light up the lake like a tiara, the crown jewel of Oakland. But the Lake Merritt that we know today actually started as a wildlife refuge. The first in the country, before Yosemite, before Yellowstone, and it's having a birthday tomorrow, celebrating 150 years as a refuge. KALW's science reporter Marissa Ortega-Welch brings us this story about the history of the refuge and how it's doing today.
There are so many fun stories that you can tell about Lake Merritt. There's the fact that Fairyland is said to have inspired Walt Disney, that Huey Newton lived in a penthouse on the south end of the lake, Sly and the Family Stone posed for an album cover on the Lake Merritt Monster Playground by the bandstand. You could really tell the whole history of Oakland through the stories of this lake. Some of my personal favorite stories, though, come from the Nature Center on the north side.
I can remember as a helper down here going in to clean those cages out in the morning, and the owls were always a little skittish. You'd have to make sure you didn't get the owls too excited or they might actually come after you.
This is Jim Cavell, who had one of the coolest summer jobs as a kid. He helped take care of the animal enclosures in front of the Nature Center on the shores of the lake. There was a coyote, a talking raven, a golden eagle.
One of the turkey vultures, her name was Minnie Haha. She would actually hop down and land on the handle of the rake. And she would just kind of walk up the handles till she got to your hands, and then she'd start picking at your fingers. And, you know, so you'd drop the rake and she would hop off, and she would go after your shoelaces and start untying your shoes.
Jim's dad, Paul Covell, was the acting naturalist at Lake Merritt's Rotary Nature Center from the 40s to the 70s. In those days, when people found injured or unreleasable wild animals, they would bring them to Paul.
We got a call one day from Disney Studios asking if we'd be interested in a sandhill crane. You know, a sandhill crane can stand four and a half feet tall. So I remember as a teenager, pretty much just we would look each other eye to eye.
Jim's dad was basically like Dr. Doolittle. Any animals that couldn't be kept at the nature center, he brought home with him.
You know, the bats in the water heater closet and the skunks that live behind the refrigerator and the raccoons on the laundry porch and...
You had bats in the water heater?
Yeah. And then they'd be, you know, nice house pets because you never see them.
Your dad didn't really leave his work at work.
No. And it wasn't work. It was a way of life for him.
Jim's dad, Paul, is thought to be the first naturalist to be put on a city payroll anywhere in the country. And he worked for the nation's first wildlife refuge, Lake Merritt. So it's a lake of many firsts. Also, it's not a lake. It's an estuary where creeks coming out of the Oakland Hills meet with the tide coming in from the San Francisco Bay.
Wherever there's fresh water and salt water that mix together is where our ancestors really created homes.
This is Karina Gould. She's the tribal chair and traditional spokesperson for the Confederated Villages of Lisechan Ohlone. She says up to the late 1700s, there were two Ohlone village sites at Lake Merritt. There was tule grass and ducks and fish.
I could imagine that people would be on the lake in their tule canoes, that there would have been fishing that was happening there. There would have been playing music. They would have been playing games. They would have been looking for food.
But in the early 1800s, the Spanish government seized the land from Karina's ancestors and gave it to one of its sergeants, Luis Peralta. In turn, some white Americans seized the land from the Peralta family. Soon, the marsh was dotted with the mansions of rich homeowners. One of those people was the mayor of Oakland at the time, Samuel Merritt.
Dr. Sam, I call him. Probably just me calling him that. But Dr. Sam would, he lived right up the street, kind of near the McDonald's, which obviously wasn't there.
This is Dorothy Lazard, head librarian at the Oakland Public Library's History Center. She says by that time, the marsh wasn't the most beautiful place to live. The city dumped its raw sewage there, and when the tide went out, it stank. So Merritt got this harebrained idea. He bankrolled damming the estuary to keep the tide from going out and turning it into a desirable place to live.
They called it Merritt's Folly. People in Oakland called it Merritt's Folly. It's like, who's going to move near here?
But it worked.
So already by 1878, they were calling it Lake Merritt. So it didn't stay a folly for very long.
As for how it became a wildlife refuge, the story goes like this. Merritt got tired of the duck hunters in his backyard. A stray bullet went through his window. Another one killed his neighbor's cow. He got the city to pass a resolution banning duck hunting. The resolution went all the way up to the state government, making it the first public wildlife refuge in the country. On the one hand, you can see this as a triumph for the birds, the start of a tradition to set aside and protect habitat. On the other hand, you could see all of Merritt's projects as really great real estate marketing.
If you look at old real estate ads, it's, you know, move to the lake. You have this Mediterranean climate. You have view of the hills. You're close to the central business district.
Regardless of the goal, the outcome was that Lake Merritt became a place for the birds.
This is an old picture from 1923, the annual Duck Festival, which was held at the lake. Where, you know, people would dance around and the ducks would fly. It was very bizarre.
If you're the kind of person who would attend a duck festival, this would have been like Lake Merritt's Renaissance period for you. The city started a daily public duck feeding program and built islands in the lake for bird habitat. In the 40s, Oakland became the first city to hire a naturalist, and that job went to Paul Covell. The Rotary Club built the Nature Center, and Paul oversaw all the programs there, including banding birds to study their migration.
My job was usually, because I was small and quick, I could grab some of these ducks and bring them out to the folks that were doing the measurements and putting the bands on.
Banding helped scientists learn that ducks who spend the winter at the lake fly north to Alaska and Canada in the summer. Lake Merritt was one of the only places on the West Coast studying this in the 40s.
I think we had a snow goose that was banded here that flew over and was actually shot by a hunter in Siberia.
But maybe you're not a bird lover. Maybe you're actually afraid of birds.
You all right?
Yes, I think so.
What happened, Mitch?
Gull hit her.
A gull?
And maybe that fear of birds comes from one movie in particular.
All at once, the birds were everywhere.
Alfred Hitchcock actually sent a movie crew to Lake Merritt to film footage of gulls for his horror flick, The Birds. Jim Cavell remembers how a couple of the animal keepers at the Nature Center stood on the shore and threw fish into the air to get the gulls to dive down, footage that was later superimposed into the film.
Tippi Hedren is out there ducking and dodging, and they were actually gulls from Lakeside Park that were just trying to grab a fish.
While Jim and I take our walk at the lake, we notice one of the big bird cages he used to clean is empty and fenced off.
Slowly closing down more and more parts of this park.
In more recent decades, the Rotary Nature Center has fallen on hard times. The cages where Minnehaha, the turkey vulture, and the raven and coyote lived are gone. The enclosure where scientists used to band birds is still there, but it's now filled with resident Canada geese and pigeons. Some of the changes here, Jim says, are a sign of the times. It's no longer acceptable to feed wild animals or keep them in small cages. But some of the changes are due to lack of resources.
You know, when I walk around the lake today, it's this part of the lake and the programs that were connected to the waterfowl refuge are, they're showing their age, and I always feel a little sense of loss here.
The city of Oakland hasn't dedicated funds for park maintenance since 2005. It's been dipping into the city's general fund to pay for services while costs have continued to rise. Oaklanders voted on Measure Q a couple weeks ago, but people I talked to said even that wouldn't be enough to make up for all the deferred maintenance. The Oakland Parks and Rec Foundation called the state of Oakland's parks a crisis. Decades after Paul Cavell retired, community groups expressed concerns of mismanagement at the Nature Center and neglect of the resident birds and reptiles that remained there. The city closed the center in 2017, citing disrepair. Volunteers relocated the animals. The center reopened last spring, and so a few weeks ago, I went to see it with Terry Smith.
Do you mind giving me a little tour first?
Sure. Terry is the president of Community for Lake Merritt, a friends group that worked with the city to reopen the Rotary Nature Center.
It's more sparse than before, but it also looks sort of cleaner.
Oh, yeah, they completely gutted the inside and painted everything, and it's a new floor, and we went through all the old taxidermy. A lot of it was in kind of bad shape.
When the city closed the Nature Center, Oakland's Parks and Rec hired a consultant to undergo a community engagement process and then made a strategic plan for the Nature Center. Terry's group is now partnering with the city to implement those plans.
The first phase was just getting everything cleaned up and sorted, and now we're looking at building program and activities and things going on. You know, it's step by step. Things in the city are slow, but we're moving forward.
Other community groups and individuals I talked to expressed concern that the city wasn't moving fast enough and wasn't prioritizing science education. I asked Nicholas Williams, director of Oakland's Parks, Recreation, and Youth Development, if his goal was to bring back the same kind of education and science programs that Lake Merritt had during Paul Cavell's era.
Absolutely. Part of our overall goal for Parks and Recreation is to reintroduce Oakland's kids to nature.
And it's starting small. They've hired two part-time naturalists, and programming there is starting to ramp up again. Jim Cavell says that's certainly what his dad, Paul Cavell, the original naturalist, would have wanted to see.
And my father was a just steadfast believer that people in the city needed access to nature as well. It was a key part of their life, and nature is all around in the city if you learn to look at it that way, and that was a big part of his life's work.
In Oakland, I'm Marissa Ortega-Welch for Cross Currents.
There will be a variety of events throughout the year to celebrate Lake Merritt's anniversary as a refuge. Go online to kalw.org to learn more. And Marissa's going to be doing a few more stories on Lake Merritt. If you've got ideas for her, email her at marissa@kalw.org. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.